Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Crime Wire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts along with noted crime consultants and attorneys often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The Crime Wire team, Vito Colucci Jr., private investigator and author, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there, on top of the crime, at the top of their game. Crime Wire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in anytime during the show. The number is 646-478-0982. And remember, you can always participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or a family member and you would like to send the Crime Wire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or you'd like to be considered for a segment on a case for a future show, email us, please, at thecrimewire@gmail.com. And it's great to be back. I miss saying that. It's been, what, 5 weeks?
Welcome back, Susan.
I am happy to be back. happy. Before we bring on Peter Hyatt, I'd like to just make a couple of announcements. One is that I'm actually on a regular network now. I'm on 4 o'clock. My Wednesday show on Blog Talk Radio has moved to 4 o'clock Eastern Time on the hearwomentalk.com at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. That's on the Zeus Radio Network. And then at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, every Wednesday night, you get a whole hour of crime with the Annie Oakley of the Airways, Dr. Lori Roth, and myself. And that place to find that show is therothshow.com. So I'm really excited because it's going to be a place for us to highlight more issues and answers and possibly resolve and provide prevention for, you know, other folks. So having said that, I am proud to introduce our next guest only because he is kicking butt on his statement analysis. Our first guest is Peter Hyatt. He is a consultant. He is an analyst as well with CrimeWire. Peter defines statement analysis, how it works, what it can determine, and its overall value as an investigative tool. He also now hosts his own Blog Talk Radio show at 6 p.m. Eastern on Sunday nights at blogtalkradio.com/Peter-Hyatt, H-Y-A-T-T, and everybody should listen in because he is really changing the way these investigations or our public's perceptions of them are. Peter, welcome to the show.
Hi, Susan. Thanks for having me.
Let's begin, because you just did this, on the missing Utah woman, Susan Powell, who vanished from her home on December 6, 2009. And you did a statement analysis of the interview, basically, that Josh Powell gave to the reporter in the Salt Lake City, Utah Tribune that was, I think, it was over the weekend that was out. And it was a long article. And you know, you basically asked the question, will Josh Powell be caught, as well as you are doing surveys as well. On this, you ask yes, sooner or later, no, he has gotten away with it. What so far since you've been doing this has been the response from folks? Do they think that he's going to get caught?
They do. People are able to see that he is incredibly quiet. He has been uncooperative from day one with the police. And without him speaking, there isn't much that anyone can do as long as the body remains missing. But human beings cannot be silent forever. And sure enough, he's starting to talk, and there will be people he'll speak to, and things will come out because our minds do not work in a vacuum, and our tongues do not work in a vacuum. So the things that are on his mind will come out. I'm just grateful that he's actually speaking.
That is an indicator. Denny, in your years of police work, is that something, are you always happy as an investigator when you see that with someone?
If people don't say anything, that's the toughest nut to crack because you have nothing to attack. once people start talking, you've got something that you can work on. You can confirm what they're saying or disprove what they're saying and that type of thing. But the people who exercise that right to remain silent, in my opinion, are among the toughest to do anything with.
What in specifics stuck out with you, Peter, when you were, you know, reading Josh Powell's words?
Oh, a number of things, Susan. As Denny said, it's really difficult if someone doesn't speak. And similar to Terry Harmon with the Karen Homer missing case, where Terry has not said much, he's finally spoken up somewhat. And sure enough, he's revealed a lot about himself.
In what way?
Well, he is an abuser. He is a controlling abuser. He has a tremendous anger and hatred towards Susan's family. And he was not able to keep that part of him down, that part of himself down. He said some real interesting things about himself. He mentioned strength a number of times, and he sounds like a poster boy for Viagra with his cough. Well, excuse me for that.
That's all right. I'm usually a bit more colorful as well, so don't worry about it.
Well, he began with the poster boy. You know, she was a good woman, a good wife, but he quickly went to the blame game, and this was the ultimate act of control, I think. This was a situation of domestic violence that had escalated into its final and sad ending.
Well, you know, I tell women all the time, in doing this work for as many years as I have, and what they need to do is be disarming. What they need to do is, and this is what I had thought, that, you know, over time, during even an argument, a simple thing like that she wasn't being as combative because she had a plan in place. And I wish you would do a statement analysis in a way for victims who, to me, do the na-na-na dance. Because when they have that secret inside of them and they're trying to make plans to leave, somehow they slip, they say something, there's a smell change in their behavior that the abuser picks up. And I wish there was a better way to gauge that for women, to say, here, do not take this step or don't do this. Or, you know, it's about trying to keep this, maintaining the same pattern of behavior during these incidences. So maybe they were arguing and she didn't, you know, talk back enough. Maybe she was whispering on the phone instead of talking in a normal tone that raised a suspicion. Maybe she had to go get something out of the glove compartment. He then starts looking. And in their own mind, what these abusers do, and this is not just Josh Powell, it's all of them, is they then build up in their mind this place of storytelling, this place of anger, this place of, well, now I'm going to take it a step further. I know she's doing this. I know she's seeing somebody. And that's what I see. So maybe there's a way to marry your statement analysis with my kind of profiling of these people, because I think that would be interesting on both sides, not just the offenders, but the victims themselves.
Yeah, there is. And remember, as you well know, many victims of domestic violence, the abusers can sometimes pass a polygraph because they don't always go violent. It's the threat of violence that keeps the victim under control. And so oftentimes it can be months and even years where there's not a violent act, but there is a threat of violence that means I don't need to use the violence because she's already under control. And those are the type of situations that they can present very well and look like the perfect family, but underneath it is that volcano of explosiveness that she is under, and she's afraid. Really fascinating point, Susan, when we ask people, especially when I interview women that I suspect are victims of domestic violence, amazingly so, they'll talk about personal hygiene, which is so strange. If I asked you, Susan, tell me about your day, you might say, my alarm went off at 6 o'clock, and I woke up, and I went to work, and et cetera, et cetera. So often we'll find that a victim of domestic violence will say, I woke up at 6 o'clock, I brushed my teeth, and I got dressed and went to work. And you say, uh-huh. Why is that a sign of domestic violence? Because they will mention, and it will come into their written statements as well, something about personal hygiene because it's an area of their lives which they can control.
That's right.
Someone that is in a violent relationship is out of control. They're always walking on eggshells. They're always nervous. That time when the bathroom door is locked and they're attending to themselves, they actually feel safe and in control. That's one of the things that we look for in a woman that we might suspect is a victim of domestic violence, talking about personal hygiene.
Yeah, and it's not anything, you know, and I forget about it all the time because it's so commonplace to me. And I don't think about it when, you know, and I realize that too, but it's not something I ever really speak about. And that is a very important point because you're right. It's where's the time in that or where's the time in the distance and the time it takes to go to work or what they have to do to drop off the children. They feel safe. He's not around. He's not watching. But now, too, with technology, with a GPS, with other things out there, it makes it very difficult to, you know, they're being tracked. And
it's
so
true.
That
it's adds
on the threats for them.
Yeah, it's everywhere. I was investigating a theft, and I had taken a statement from a young woman, and sure enough, there it was, that she talked about the alarm clock going off and talked about brushing her teeth, and that was part of her written statement. Now, everyone that woke up this morning brushed their teeth. Hardly anyone, you know, 1 out of 100 might say that they brushed their teeth. It's something that's not considered important enough to mention because we all do it. The fact that she mentioned it, as I went to speak to her in her home, sure enough, out came her boyfriend, and he stood very close to me, and he gave me that overcompensating handshake and wanted me to know how strong he was, and then he left the room, and then he came back. The third time he came back into the room, he was shirtless, and he was obviously sending that rooster signal. She was in a bad situation and had been likely bullied into giving out information about the company, which allowed the theft to go forward. And so this was a situation where he used that violent threat over her to gain access to where she her place of employment for the purpose of theft. So it is far-reaching. It is deep. It is as quiet and kind of a secret of shame that sometimes is born that we have to dig out and root out. It's difficult, as you know.
In your statement of Josh, you say she can't come back with them treating her this way, Josh Powell said. They want her to be perfect, a saint with no fallibility. Now, this is relatory because she can't come back, he tells anyone who is listening. Josh Powell is doing what guilty homicidal victims do. Is that true? How is that possible? How is in analyzing the domestic homicide?
It is an amazing statistic that goes back to 911 calls that when someone calls 911 during a homicide, a domestic homicide, there are indicators of guilt and there are indicators of innocence. One of the first indicators we have of guilt is if they greet the 911 operator. So you saw this recently with Adam Baker, Zara, the missing girl, and he said to the operator, "How you doing?" And then he went on to disparage the victim. And so another thing that the guilty callers do in the 911 calls is they will disparage the victim. They will, if a baby is shaken, they'll talk about the baby in bratty terms and sometimes not even ask for help of the victim. Well, in Baker's situation, he complained about Zara. You know, she's getting close to puberty and she wouldn't come out of her room. He was talking about an alleged kidnapping, but obviously from the call it wasn't a kidnapping but a domestic homicide. Well, Josh Powell does the same thing. Is he begins off with the you know, she was a good wife, and then he can't help himself. He begins to disparage her. And then even more disgusting, Susan, is you see where Josh got this. His father said, quote, "Susan's very sexually motivated, and she's very financially motivated."
That was my post today. That was, and that's before I forget, because this is really cool to be able to do this. What got me on, and I've been splitting up on my posts, tearing this apart. So when he said she knows she will be chewed up like hamburger when she comes back. Now a reporter asked me about it last night. I said, "Do you want my real take on that?" Because I know he served her a plate of food that night. But my thing right away when I saw that was, she knows she will be chewed up like hamburger. Does that mean that he made sure she was covered in some kind of a meat and chewed up by dogs or wolves or something way out in that area? That's what hit me.
If you look at that language, and when this is resolved, Susan, I think you're going to find that you were right or at least close by. It had something, the language that he chose is purposeful. He's thinking about what he did to her while he's speaking.
But,
so yeah, I think you're on the right track. Absolutely.
I mean, she knows she will be chewed up, but she already was chewed up. See, and that, like I said, if you're unconscious, you know, he handed her a plate of food, and that's a fact. He carefully, meticulously went in the kitchen, prepared it, handed each person the food, and he talks about the yarn, like, you know, you're not coming back or she won't be here. and that is troublesome. But to me, that's what I feel. I feel that we're not going to find her because of how he disposed of her. And then, yeah, let's talk about the father, guys. Let's talk about. Okay, go ahead.
Susan, if you could back up just a minute on your point about the quote about being chewed up. I think that what he's telling us is right along the veins of what you're saying. In the outdoors, he left her out after the violent act to be chewed up by wild animals, and he may have done something where he had prepped the body or whatever.
Yes,
but
he knows
these words are not chosen in a vacuum, and this is so important. Do you remember and I don't mean to go off too much on a tangent, but this is what the purpose is, in the vacuum. Do you remember when Cindy Anthony sabotaged the search efforts by Tim Miller for Kaylee Anthony, and she threw Tim Miller out of the house? She went to media, she walked up, and she said, "George and I don't believe that Kaylee's in the woods or anything." What made her think of the woods? She knew exactly where that baby was.
And because, remember when she opened the trunk, I'll never forget this as well, and she called 911 and said, it smells like there's a dead body in the back, and she's a nurse, so she would know that smell. She says it immediately.
Yeah, not only that, but the human reflex gag reflex, is instinctively put in when we smell human decomposition. If you have no training in that at all, and you smell it once, you'll never forget it. 30 years
That's
later,
right.
You'll never forget it. So she knew exactly what it was saying. But my point was that when she chose those words, they were chosen because they were in her mind. She's thinking about Kaylee when she said this. When Josh Powell was talking about Susan, he was thinking exactly where he left that body, where it could be exposed to wild animals. That's where he lived, in that area.
That's right. And that, to me, and again, you know, who takes their children out at you know, some ungodly hour of the night, Denny, to go camping?
Yeah, that whole story, I found it bizarre. That's credulity, I would say.
It's amazing. And now let's talk about the father. Again, in my post today, I basically rip him a new rear end, and I basically want to know how the hell does he know there's a Kool-Aid stain under a couch? That he answers to the reporter, I'm sorry, yeah, she had a clean day, a couple weeks before. How would he know that? Does he live there? How would he know that?
How dismissive. Of a victim. What a horrible attitude that he has. Not only does he deride her for being sexually and financially motivated, but then he says, it was juice or something. Just completely dismissing the fact that she's been missing all this time. And he knows. Let's not mistake that one. He knows Josh.
Oh, please. I think he helped. And I think that because Josh Powell and his brother have been diagnosed with medical conditions that require certain types of drugs, I think that was ground up in her food. I really believe that, so that she was just wiped out, couldn't move, couldn't do anything. I still say that the kids were fed some Benadryl so they could be knocked out, so there was no screams, no loud noises of any type, so they wouldn't know. And I wish that one of the cops – there were so many things. You know, as first responders, I try to really teach these guys. So much evidence, so much information is gone, lost, because – first responders, because this is a marital situation, they are not trained, and it's not to speak ill of anybody. I'm just saying that thinking outside the box like you do and with what you're doing, it's the same thing, what has to happen on the crime scene. I've still not seen it yet. So when I see things afterwards, right away I say, well, why did you guys do this, 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 and this? It's not something that you think about. And they had a perfect opportunity to do many things, and they didn't because, in my opinion, Josh Powell disarmed them. With the boys, and when they showed up, and the police were there already because they were doing a wellness check. But this father, when he says that, okay, and Mr., where are the so-called friends that they're talking about, that they say this about Susan? He's telling individuals things to see what will stick up against the wall. Again, he seems to be 50% of this interview, and he makes statement about a loving, caring person who has vanished without a trace. I think he's just as guilty. I'm sorry. I do.
Well, he may be, but I'll tell you this. Take a look at his other child, his daughter.
That's right.
She, I think that she's going to have more to say, especially now that this has come out where they have really ripped into a victim. Just about the worst thing you can do. But I think that when he talked about she being very sexually motivated, when he repeated the word strength several times, I wasn't making a joke so much about the Viagra commercial. I'm telling you, this guy is an impotent abuser. He's one of these horribly insecure, guy with sexual issues and control issues, and he's dangerous. And as I mean, that's an understatement now that it's in hindsight, but he's dangerous to the next woman that falls prey to him. Someone will think that he's a teddy bear and he's gentle. Underneath that facade, we saw some of the hateful words coming out of him and his father. And I think that the sister is going to give us more information as time goes on about violence that was in that household growing up.
That's right, because the mother, allegedly now, and this, there was something that happened in the same way where the Josh and his brother, I don't know if the sister was born yet or she possibly was, they were taken, abducted. There was an abduction. There was an issue there. There was some things that happened as to how he was treated. And, you know, here Susan makes more money than he does. She's well-liked in the community. She's trying to do everything that she can. And, you know, she says, I'm done, which that's where women make the mistakes of acknowledging,
yeah,
announcing. They don't have a plan in place. You know, and that has to happen. They can, they must go to my website and do the evidentiary abuse affidavit first and foremost. You know, if you need some help, email me at murphymilano@gmail.com, because, you know, there's a police officer's wife in Elizabeth, New Jersey that I worked with, and we went back and forth, very dangerous guy, you know, with cards and letters and some other things, and what he was going to do. I didn't know that she had court the next morning last week, and I went ahead, and after we secured everything, she sent me the razor. She sent me everything that I had asked for. She had prepared the video and affidavit and then other documents that were necessary. And I read her the post before we went on, you know, before I let it go. And then she said that morning for the first time in court, she said that they were passing around the blog, and it was on the judges at the judge's chamber. She saw it, and it was the first time they didn't return the guy's guns. And I had said, "Now one hair is going to come off on this girl's head," because the brother's related to a police officer. She was to me a Kathleen Savio, Drew Peterson's wife, waiting to happen. She had written to everyone. She said, "Please help me. I'm going to be killed." And we have to take a stronger stance on these cases. And there's information and there's tools available for people. Susan Powell didn't get that opportunity because she just didn't. And that's what has to happen, because this bozo, as you know, Denny, would not be walking around. If she had done this evidentiary abuse affidavit and video, he'd be arrested the next morning. And that's, if you do nothing else, that's just important. I mean, that saves so much grief for these families, and it removes this bullshit that these guys get to do. Peter, how can, why, I mean, it's great that he talked to the reporter and everything, but why are we giving these abusers this kind of press when the victims still haven't been found and they're out there? What's the mindset? Because I think it really hurts victims.
Well, think about her parents, and this is the height of cruelty. Now, an abuser will, if you want to know, is this man an abuser, is this man capable of doing harm? If he is able to articulate it, he is able to complete it. If he's able to say it, and often abusers will say what they do before they do it. And so if they threaten to wring a neck, they will wring a neck. If they threaten to punch, they will punch. If they threaten to kill, they're capable of killing. I know it's hard to believe, but it comes first in the language. They're able to articulate it. They're able to complete it. But think of Susan's parents. Josh Powell, in all his cruelty, knowing that he has snuffed out her life, he then calls for Susan's parents to be investigated. For what? That's just nothing more than a horrific insult that he's laying upon them, and he's taunting them. And I think that Susan had a sense of dignity and probably a strong intellect. She was affable, well-liked among people. All signs that she was just a really good person. He couldn't bear it. He couldn't bear it, and he couldn't outspend her and make himself look like a hotshot with his spending, this type of inadequate offender. I think the sexual problems that were associated with him, I think that her family rightfully looked at him and said, you know, this guy is dragging our daughter down. And I think probably she was getting close, perhaps, to getting away from him. And this,
there were, by all accounts, yes, she was. By all accounts, she was doing certain things at work. She was putting things together. She, you know, again, she was making her plan, but she was not, you know, secretive enough about it. She she, you know, and that's the problem too that I see with a lot of the people that are involved with intimate partner homicide or violence is what happens is it's the na-na-na dance. You know, they feel a little bit happy, secure. They let down their guard a little bit, and they say things or do things that, you know, aren't the normal routine. He doesn't see that fear anymore, and that's what Josh Paul banked on. And then, you know, that was his bread and butter ticket there.
Yeah, that
and
fear
for him,
is like a, sorry, Susan, yeah, that fear, they sense that. It's like an adrenaline rush to them. They
yeah.
live off that fear. And when they see the slightest bit of independence, that slightest uptick in the voice, or as you said, just that sense that she's just a little bit better off, it enrages them. And our statistics show that once the woman has made that move, now she's at the highest risk. Now that the control has been lost and he's going to strike back. It is so difficult at times to convince them because the abuser is often very charming. He'll come back and he's penitent and he's sorry. He'll suddenly get religion and begin to pull that into his life. And if you listen carefully enough, he'll blame his own mother. He'll blame others. It's generally a hatred towards women in general, a hatred towards weakness that he must exploit. And this guy, this is why he went after the parents. He said, and I think this is an indication of how violent he is, someone needs to take the velvet gloves off and treat them, the Coxes, like an investigative subject. What do you mean take the velvet gloves off? Take off the gentle treatment. If anyone is going to give a warning about not being gentle, it's Josh Powell. This is a violent, explosive man. And I tell you, I pity the girl in the bar or wherever he is that he picks up next, if he hasn't already.
Hopefully he's not. I mean, he's got the two little kids. He's on the compound with the father. And again, I think that maybe, you know, and nobody has seen the brother, or the brother hasn't come out, but I'm told the brother is very dangerous. I'm told that he has some serious mental health issues that are dangerous. And, you know, who knows if somebody drove down there? Nobody was able to check that. They don't interview the father, Steve Powell, until sometime in May. There's also songs and things that this jackass, pardon me, writes. He is in love with this woman. You know, there was somebody that said to me, well, could they be holding her captive? And this was early on when this happened, and I got some phone calls, like you do, and we were going over the case. And this woman wanted me to tell her that Susan Powell is alive. And I said, you know, I'll bet the farm she's not. And she goes, how can you say that? I said, I've been doing this for so long. And I don't say that lightly about anybody or anything. I am very careful. I really am. I mean, I try to give certain benefit of the doubt. I know that these guys don't take the body very far or drive very far because they can't take the risk. You know, we go back to Drew Peterson, and, you know, let me go back even further. Recently, Teresa Parker's body was found 3 years after, just a couple of months ago, and Sam Parker, who was the police officer in Georgia, had actually been tried for murder and found guilty of her murder, but they hadn't found the body. They just found it. And it was very interesting to me because I was teasing somebody. We were on this conference call, and I said, you know, where did he used to play trains as a kid? And I'll be darned if, you know, 2 or 3 weeks later, they went to his boyhood area, and that's where the body was. With Josh Powell, you're not going to find that. I think with Stacey Peterson, you might, because they're going to go where they know, aren't they, Denny?
Yeah.
That would be a pretty good bet. Yes.
Everybody, no matter what, is going to bury where they know, where they're comfortable with disposing, where they're comfortable with driving. Because again, with technology, with going through toll booths, like since Venus Stewart is still missing and she was abducted from the mailbox, his family did not live very far away. He did not drive back to Newport, Virginia from Michigan. That body is just a mile or two away because they're not going to take the chance. They could get hit rear-ended. Something could happen. The body could pop back out of the trunk. They're not going far. And I don't think Stacy's very far. But in this case, I don't think you're going to find her. I think that the dogs did get her. I think that he made sure of it because of his language and how he chewed her up real quick. And you're going to stay with us, right, for the Harringtons, correct, Peter?
Yes, I will.
Okay. All right. Real quick, Lisa. Tiffany Hartman, Hartley. I saw that when I was on the road when it happened, and I yelled out right away when I saw it in the morning on the interview, and I said, she's lying. And people looked at me. I said, she's not telling you guys the truth. And I walked out. I was embarrassed that I said it so loudly. Right away, what was it about her that you caught your attention immediately? Because here she was crying. You know, there was a Mexican man who they haven't been able to identify that made the 911 call, but I think he was just repeating what she was saying, and nobody asked him or could find him afterwards. What's your take on that?
You know, I wasn't into the case much at all, and someone sent me an email saying, would you please look at this interview? And I, being not familiar with the case, sometimes the best way to do it, and the first thing I noticed was the passive language. Passive language is used, you know, for example, the gun went off. Do you want to tell us who caused the gun to go off? Because guns don't just go off. So when someone uses passive language, they're attempting to hide identity. And then she said the Mexican bandits, and they were young men. And then later on, she called them people. She changed her language, attempt to hide it. So right off the bat, she had, I think, 9 or 10 indicators of deception within a very short interview. So she knows. What I don't know is why she's being deceptive. Either she has killed him herself, or she had him killed. And, of course, there's a theory now that's floating around that's gaining some strength that David may still be alive, and this is part of an insurance scam that he's in on. But there is no mourning on her part. There is language that is using to hide the identity of the shooter. There is, of course, the number 3, which is a liar's number, which is used repeatedly. Indicator after indicator, she knows what happened on September 30th, and she is being deceptive about it. Yet everyone and their mother is praising her as courageous and as a heroine, and politicians are falling behind her and praising her as well. And they're condemning any of us who think that she's lying. But the Mexican investigator that was beheaded, he wasn't beheaded on her behalf. He was trying to nail 2 guys who had been wanted on other issues, and the Mexican prosecutor went off and said, this guy went on his own. And he answered for that. But this wasn't related to the David Hartley case at all. They don't believe her. They think she's lying. She's got a hot potato political thing going on for a great distraction. Tiffany Hartley is being deceptive. I'll bet my career on it.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. Denny, want to introduce our next guest, please?
Yes. Tonight we're going to do an update on the case of Morgan Harrington. And Morgan's the young lady who disappeared from a Metallica concert at the University of Virginia on October 27th, 2009, and her remains were found the following January. Her killer remains at large. And tonight, joining us to discuss the status of the case and how they are coping with the case, the lack of an arrest in the case, are Dan and Gil Harrington, Morgan's parents. Good evening, Dr. and Mrs. Harrington.
Hello, how are you?
Hello.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for coming back on the program.
We appreciate the opportunity.
And before we get into anything else, you attended over the weekend a rally, I believe a road rally for justice for Morgan.
Yes, we had a rally that began in our hometown of Roanoke, and we traveled to Charlottesville to the bridge where Morgan was last seen, and from there we went to Northern Virginia to Fairfax. And the reason that we did this was obviously to raise awareness of Morgan's case, but importantly to raise awareness of the connection, the forensic connection between Morgan's case and a 2005 rape that occurred in Fairfax City. And from that rape in 2005, there was a witness and who was able to give a sketch drawing of the perpetrator to the police. 5 years is a long time, and so even though this information was released in July of this year, we felt that the community had really not paid much notice of the connection to the Morgan Harrington case. And so we traveled to the 3 cities and had a number of interviews with the press and with local newspapers.
Dr. Harrington, can I ask you, how close was the incident from where your daughter was discovered to this other offense in 2005?
Well, that's the confusing thing about this, is that Fairfax is about an hour and a half north of Charlottesville, And so here's the rape in 2005. And then, of course, one of the confusing issues in Charlottesville is that Morgan's body was found in a remote part of a 700-acre farm that is quite isolated, and the police feel that that information is actually an important piece of this, in that this farm and where Morgan was placed is not just some place that anyone would stumble upon. They would have had to have known it. So how does the forensic link of these two cases with this particular individual come together? You know, it's a puzzle that still has some pieces that are missing.
I'm curious, Doctor, if you know, after I've read various postings and so forth about that this area where Morgan's remains were found was known to be frequented sometimes by police or off-duty police and what they called booty excursions and so forth. Is that anything you've heard about, and do you see any correlation between Morgan's disappearance and death and what this particular geographical area where she was found allegedly takes place in that area?
Well, I don't know that I know the answer to that question. The farm where she was found is an estate, and so it is an area that frequently has hunters on it. There are people who party there.
But I guess, Mr. Harrington, what Denny was trying to say was that in March of 2010, a group of Abermarley police officers were known to have frequented that specific farm where they were doing alleged drugs, and they were doing booty calls out there in that specific area where they found Morgan.
Yeah, that's not information that I have heard before.
I have heard some little whiffs of that before, but...
And they've kept it quiet. The police have kept it quiet. And Peter Hyatt, weigh in on this, will you please? I mean, I think, you know, I see something a little different. What do you think?
Yeah, it's something that has to be explored, and it's something that those in leadership do not want brought out. Even if it has no legs to it, it still smells bad.
Oh, no, this thing's got legs. I'm looking at the legs right now, and I'm sorry, but, I mean, this is just maddening to me, because you've got four police officers. Two were demoted, two lost their jobs over this whole thing that an NBC channel out there has tried to get information, and also the chief is... You know, no, I think he's resigned already. You know, it was reported by NBC 29 HD News. And they can't get a handle on certain things, but that's what happened out there. And, you know, people go where they know, don't they, Denny? I mean, there's just something about this whole thing that doesn't feel correct to me, that is such an isolated place.
It's curious to me then, if you are looking at kind of a connection with law enforcement through a funny way, how does that tie in with DNA link from Morgan to a 2005 abduction, rape, and assault? Doesn't fit with that.
Dan?
Well, there's some possibilities. Let me just say we did a profile case a couple of weeks ago out of Houston, Texas, called the Lovers Lane murders. And what we found there, what we believe there, is that the DNA, and it was very similar in the sense that there was subsequently a rape victim, and it turned out that the same DNA was matched up from the rape victim with the murdered girl. And according to sources I've spoken with, they believe that there was more than one person involved. And one person, in fact, left DNA and still had other people present at the scene or participated somehow in the event. So,
I can see that, because if you would look into the face of the composite that has been released from 2005, It is not a face that any woman would go with willingly.
And here's this is Denny's and mine. Or Denny, why don't you say it so I don't say what we spoke about earlier. It sounds better coming out of you.
Well, yeah, you always wonder what. Well, first of all, I'm not a DNA expert, but is it possible? Do you think can there be any cases where somehow there's contaminated DNA, or maybe it's not quite as reliable? Is there any chance that either there could have been a problem with the DNA testing, or how it was obtained?
This is what we were, going over. Aside from that, here, this is, and Peter helped me out. She's at the concert. She can't come back in. She sees somebody that she trusts, perhaps somebody that is not on duty, okay?
The person she trusted was not the guy in the composite. I think the composite guy was the helper man. There's definitely more than one person involved.
That's right. And so they see this, perhaps it's somebody that's off duty, perhaps, and something happened. And Peter, I know, and I've seen this before, and we were trying to find cases earlier that were similar to this, and I couldn't find them, where it went wrong. Something happened. And then what was made to look like something was not what – no one expected the accident, a snap of a neck, something. Oh, my gosh, well, what are we going to do? And then other things happen to throw everybody off.
You have a place where she might have seen someone that she would have normally trusted, not necessarily by recognition, by the fact that he's an officer. The problem with that is that while they were still on the force, you can polygraph. Once they're off the force, they can refuse the polygraph, and the opportunity is lost. So
this is the first time this is even being brought up. I mean, it's never been brought up before until now.
Okay. But it may be being brought up now, but if something did actually happen, then someone knows about it, and someone within that organization would know about this as well. And to not explore... especially in that type of rural area, to not explore this. Bodies don't go missing every day in that area. That I know. That's something that would have to be explored. It's crazy not to.
But it's also kept quiet with the investigation of how these officers lost their job and that how much time they had spent out there. So, again, I would think that there's a possibility that people would go where they know something went wrong. Because that, just to me, is too much of a desolate area to not know your way around, to not know how to get out of there. And I never thought that when I saw that composite that person was responsible, in my opinion. Again, I could be way off base, but I just never felt that person, that they have that sketch out for, that they released, pretty quick all of a sudden. And I'm just saying other avenues need to be looked at. Nobody is pointing fingers, but, she's gone, and people need answers, not the runaround, which is what I think they're continuing to get the Harringtons, is runaround.
Hey, she's gone, and there's some bad behavior that has to be looked into. Once you mix that type of drugs and alcohol and the element of trust, because I agree with you in terms of the composite, no, she's not going to go with something like that.
No.
To me, this whole thing looks staged. It does. It smells staged. It feels staged. It just... In looking at it from a different perspective, that was the first hit I got, over the summer. I thought, and this was after, just something didn't add up to me. Things just didn't make any sense, and it still doesn't make any sense. And if you are, how big is the police department, Mr. Harrington?
Well, it's a fairly large county, and not terribly populous. It probably has 150,000 people in the area. So, it's not a teeny police department, but, we have not dealt with the Albemarle County Police much at all in this investigation. It's been in the hands of originally the University of Virginia Police, and it was handed off to the Virginia State Police with they're working with Charlottesville City and Albemarle County, but in our dealings over the last 12 months with police, I cannot even recall meeting anyone from the Albemarle Police Department.
But there's a relationship between that police department in the 2005 crime, a relative, and in Albemarle.
You may very well be right. I do agree with Jill. I don't think that Morgan would have gotten in the car with this person.
No. So there's a connection there. So maybe Peter, in the middle of this, somebody calls somebody and says, listen, I got this going on. You got to get me out of it, brother. And this person works in that area. They remember the 2005 crime. Let's pin it somewhere else. Nobody's going to know.
And his DNA and put it on her.
That's right. That's right.
I mean, that's pretty tricky.
It is pretty tricky, but so is how she was killed and the way that she was killed. And that other man in that 2005 crime, he let that girl go. They don't let them go.
He was interrupted, and she was badly hurt.
She was, but she would have, you know, in that way. It was just, it seemed to me kind of odd. By accident, you were on a show I did on that Monday, and then all of a sudden on Wednesday, there was all this fire with this whole thing. They had a composite, and the chief of police was retiring. I just thought it was just strange behavior. Maybe it was coincidental. Maybe I'm making too much of it.
I appreciate the heads up on that. We drove a couple of weeks ago. We've never been back to the farm where Morgan was found, but we kind of drove around it, and there is no way. There were thousands of places on the way from the concert to where Morgan's body was left, where you could put a girl. It was really, when you say the word staged, someone had planned this all out ahead of time, and they just wanted to, they needed to cast the role of leading victim. This was pre-planned.
Which may indicate that something went awry, where they, you know, the good old boys perhaps went too far, not knowing their limitations with alcohol or drugs, and then the staging and cover-up happens. It's a horrible thought, but there should not be a single stone that's left unturned.
No, and then think about this, Mr. and Mrs. Harrington. Think about the kids at the concert or somebody that may have said something or done something. We see this all the time, although people don't get caught. There are wonderful law enforcement across the country, and I'm not saying that this is anything bad, but, you know, if you have a reputation, or if you know, and if there's an arrest of somebody, and, you know, they say, well, you know, how do you want to make it up to me? And perhaps it's out there in that, you know, in an area that's secluded, and that's where they take them. And again, if it is documented that they did booty calls out there, documented, if that's what they lost their jobs over, documented again, then I would strongly suggest that some heads start rolling, because these guys lost all this. A lot of stuff happened just before her body was located, and then after an officer kills himself. Somebody that's been on the force a long time, you know, there's things that it's almost like to me, Peter and Denny, it's like somebody keeping secrets and they can't keep them anymore. And there's a reaction now, a domino reaction effect going on. And again, I know that this stuff has never been spoken about, but it's time now, because nobody's coming up with the answers. To me, they're coming up with things that do not make sense. And, you know, it's time. And it's not about no one doing their job. I just don't think that anybody's looking under the cracks and crevices of perhaps where information and evidence might be.
I think the difficulty when you present this and talk about this is as a parent of someone who's been murdered, how do you even approach this? I mean, it's you know, if there are cover-ups, et cetera, you know, we're not going to be the people who are able to get people talking. That's for sure. I mean, that's the frustrating point to me, is that, you know, we have little power in this paradigm.
Peter?
Yes, I have a question for Dr. Harrington. Two questions, actually, Dr. Private investigator? Any chances?
Well, we hired a private investigator that was, unfortunately, not particularly a good outcome.
Can you let a lot, can you, Peter, can we come up with something off the air for them? I know we can. That would make more sense.
Yeah, actually, part of my second question is, was a profiler down at the location, at the crime scene?
The profiler that has been used is the profiler for the Virginia State Police.
Okay.
We've had offers of profilers who are with national reputations who have offered to come, and they've not been welcome to come.
By whom, though?
By the police.
By the police.
By Virginia State Police?
Yes.
Yeah, that's where the media noise has to come in, because those profilers, some of the nationally known ones, have built a reputation for a reason, and this is not about showing up anyone. This is about progressing forward in the case, and there has to be an element of media exposure then that can cause them to yield and allow the profiler to come in and do his work. That's terribly frustrating to hear.
Peter, can we come up with something, you know, similar, you know, things I did in Oklahoma were pretty successful. Maybe we could brainstorm afterwards, and then Mr. and Mrs. Harrington, if you want. I mean, we can talk about it, because we did make so much progress on three cases that, you know, are being opened right now because of this, because of exactly how I'm speaking to you. And I wait a while and see, because when we put these things together, you do have a right to know, and it has been tormenting for you. And it, you know, this person needs to be caught, because, as Mrs. Harrington, as you have said, they're showering every day. They're going to dinner someplace. As you said many times, I've heard you on many, many shows. They are out there among us, this person, and they need to be brought to justice.
Yeah, and I am not willing to sit back, and we want to find justice. We wanted to find Morgan. We don't want to wait for the DNA hit from the next woman that he harms. That's not how I want to find this guy. I want to shake him out of the tree.
And Dr. Harrington, if you can tell me, I don't know, you know, how much contact or updates you get from the police investigators, but do you have any feel for the number or the responses they've gotten to this composite? Did they get at least initially maybe a lot of calls where people thought they had seen this person, or
yes, they have gotten calls from the July release. Certainly, you know, right after the release was made, there were quite a few calls. Just this weekend, with this road rally that we did to Northern Virginia, there actually have been a fair number of calls of people who, you know, say that this looks like someone. You know, again, you know, sketches like this can be not terribly accurate. So, you know, that's part of, I think, the difficulty that we have. At least we do have a sketch. That is a plus. But, you know, who knows how accurate it actually is, and it's 5 years old.
Right. And one of, I was reading earlier today, one of your supporters, who I believe was at the rally, indicated in a post that this individual, you know, he, even though 5 years, yes, the appearance could have changed certainly over 5 years, but that this person, if he's still anywhere in the area, stops at restaurants or stops at gas stations, grocery shops, gets a haircut, what have you, if he's in the community, you'd think that someone, you know, would have spotted the real deal. In other words, not
right.
I don't know. That's just the way my feeling. After I read that post, I said, you know, that's true. If somebody's in the community, living in the community, somebody would have to see him.
Well, that's certainly our hope, and what we had planned for this weekend is that we, you know, raise the awareness, particularly in Northern Virginia, where there seemed to not be an awareness of, number one, the rape, but also the forensic connection to Morgan's death. And I think we were successful in getting some awareness that had not been there before.
Well, you know, and I want to, first of all, commend you and Gil and and your friends and supporters for keeping this going, because there's no doubt in my mind that you can't let these cases get too far out of the public attention. You have to keep them alive, and whatever it takes. And of course, obviously, if you can interest the media, that is a that's a tremendous thing. And a lot of our listeners are also have had cases profiled on our show. And talking about coping with this type of thing, having that stamina to keep this alive and make the phone calls and go for the interviews and so forth, have how tough has that been? And do you have any hints or tips for people in a similar situation about keeping that story alive until you can find the justice you're looking for?
Well, I think we've had just incredible support over the last year, and without the support of people that we didn't even know a year ago, I don't know that we would have had the energy to do all this. We are tired, and we have been on any television show or media that is willing to talk to us. But I think that families have to be willing to be somewhat transparent and be willing to put themselves out, because in a case of a missing person or a death, there's such a short window in which you can grab the public's attention, because after a week or 2 weeks, there are three more cases that are moving in behind that are interesting or more interesting than yours. And I think we have been able to keep Morgan's case out there probably better than the average person. And I think that our use of social media has really kept Morgan's case alive. And we have had very good relationships with all the media that we have dealt with.
But it's not for everyone to do this way. I mean, we understand that some people and perhaps they are able to be further along in the processing grief because we have put so much energy into trying to find justice for Morgan that maybe we're behind on the other arm of the equation. But, you know, we're medical people, and the skills that we have from our professions have helped us to be able to put the emotions aside for a while to pursue justice for our murdered daughter. But after a year of shaking the trees, we're getting to the edges of our abilities to do so. You know,
you're still doing it. You know, again, you know, it's in just that Oklahoma 10-year-old case. More has been done in the last couple of weeks. This is 10 years old, this case. And it's now like lightning. And yes, they are tired. And yes, they are tired of putting together the packets and passing them out. And anybody that will listen. But as I think I've heard you say, Mrs. Harrington, every day you get up, that person gets up to somewhere else. And every day that they have a breath to take, you're taking a bigger breath, because you know that you're not going to rest until justice is done and this person is caught. And it's also your faith, both of your faith in God, that's what keeps you going. And if he's not going to win. The person's not going to win, period.
I wanted to limit the damage that he did. You know, he caught us at point of impact and killed our daughter, but no more than that.
That's right.
We cannot rest.
That's right. And there is, like I said, there is hope. Every day I see it. And when I began this work at the very beginning, you know, after the first year and then second year, I didn't think so. I didn't believe it. But every day I see miracles now. Every day I see that those people who want to cut you off at the pass, who when you do the work that you're doing, when they say things sometimes that are negative, they don't understand, they don't get it, and because of it, you also help so many other families. We are out of time. Give us the website, please, Mrs. Harrington.
I'll go ahead and give it. The website is www.findmorgan.com, and there's a Facebook page, Help Find Morgan Harrington.
We will figure out a game plan after the show and in the next few days, and then one of us, either Peter or I, will get back to you. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Bless
you
both.
Very much. Thank you.
Thank you to the CrimeWire team, our Director of Research, Kim Colton, and Public Relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be Tuesday, November 16th, 2010. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases, crimes, and interrupt and wreak havoc on families looking for answers, seeking justice. Also, thank you to Peter Hyatt for being a guest on the show and also participating.
And thank you all for joining us tonight on CrimeWire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guests. If you would like your case to be featured on CrimeWire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. And you can hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show at www.crimewire.blogspot.com. And remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. Visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. Good night. God bless from the CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci Jr., Denny Griffin, and Susan Murphy Milano. Thank you.
Good night, everybody.
Night.
Hey, Dan, let's catch up tomorrow and get them for the Harrington. Let's put together a plan and we'll get this thing going, okay?
We'll do that.
All right. Oh, they're still on. Okay. All right.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night, everybody.